Grant me justice. Go away. Grant me justice. Go away. This parable, depending upon the version of the English translation and the editors, I suppose, can be known as the unjust judge and the persistent widow. It's also, I've seen, listed with a heading, the unjust judge, the persistent widow. One or the other, depending, I don't know, on who the editors, the translators thought the story was really about. But it does seem we are to make something of those two categories because of the descriptions. Did Jesus want the people who heard the parable to think about who they related with more? I think probably all of us have learned to associate ourselves with the persistent widow. After all, this is about persistence in prayer and keeping heart and staying firm. And after all, we all probably know what it's like to want something, to need something, and to not be able to get it, obstacles in the way. And maybe it's a very small thing that we want, and it may not have a huge effect on our well-being or on our survival. Or it might be that we know what we need and we've figured out a way to make it happen on our own. And no one has stepped in our way. No one has said, you can't have it. But we also likely know, are familiar with the situation where we know what we need and we can't get it because someone is in the way. Or someone has determined that, no, we shouldn't have it. Or there just doesn't seem to be enough of whatever it is to go around. And depending on what that need is, it can have serious effects on our life. We need food. We need shelter. We need a livelihood that can support food, shelter, clothing, education. And so maybe it is that we don't have a job. Or we don't have a job that pays a living wage. Or we, whoever we are, have been shut out of that particular job. This parable comes in the midst of a discourse about the coming of the kingdom. What will the kingdom look like? And we might well ask, in this situation, with a judge, an unjust judge, what does justice look like? And who brings it about, and whose responsibility is it to see that justice is done? Right from the very beginning, Jesus in this parable makes it clear who we are dealing with. The judge is unjust. No two ways about it. It's not, you know, the unkind judge or the indifferent judge or the judge who just was busy that one day. It is clearly the unjust judge who doesn't care about God, doesn't care about people. And so we are primed, as we listen to this, to not expect very much. It would be foolish to expect anything, perhaps. And we have the widow. She has rights that need to be protected. She has been wronged. And over again, we're reminded in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, of God's concern for and directives concerning people in that very situation, the most vulnerable people in a society, the vulnerable people mentioned over and over and over again by the prophets, widows, orphans, and foreigners. So I don't think Jesus was just picking any old person to be in this parable. In Deuteronomy, we read, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who is not partial and takes no bribe, who executes justice for the orphan and the widow, and who loves the strangers, providing them with food and clothing. You shall also love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Very specific about what justice looks like. Also, in Deuteronomy, you shall not deprive a resident alien or an orphan of justice. You shall not take a widow's garment in pledge. Don't take from people who already have very, very little. The people most likely in this scenario to be without resources, particularly if they have been taken advantage of. This seems to be the case that Jesus is setting up in this parable. If we fast forward to our lives outside of the Bible, often questions about justice are wrapped up in what people deserve, what they have coming to them in direct proportion to what they have done to earn it. So what does a person who works at, XYZ job deserve? What does a person who is a loyal customer at a business deserve? What does someone who has committed an offense deserve? If they get what they deserve, we think, well, that's justice. And so justice, as we understand it in our day-to-day lives, is meted out in dollars, in units of time. Because you have this prestigious position, you get 4 weeks of vacation. Because you earn minimum wage, or you don't even have a job, you don't get time off. And when we live in a highly individualized context like we do here in North America, that sense of who deserves what gets even more heightened, right? I spend all this money in your establishment. I deserve to be treated like an important person. When I come in here, I want immediate attention because, after all, I'm the reason you're in business. I spent all this money and all this time getting this person elected. I deserve to have them listen to me. Except, in God's economy, our human notion of justice gets turned on its head. And even as we live in this time when there's a lot of public conversation about what people deserve, we also ought to ask, what are the things to which people have just a right, a human right? Often, I think the assumptions being made about who gets what are driven by the assumption that there's just not enough to go around. Everybody can't have what they need, sorry, but there's just not enough to go around. And so, a phrase that I use often in my classroom when I'm talking about injustice, the old, it sucks to be you paradigm. Biblical scholar and theologian Walter Brueggemann wrote an essay in the late 90s titled The Liturgy of Abundance and the Myth of Scarcity. And he writes that in the story of creation, he writes about the story of creation and the relationship between humanity and God. In the story of creation is this beautiful litany of abundance. God creates a world that is overflowing with abundance and goodness. And Brueggemann says that Genesis 1 is a song of praise for God's generosity. And he says that some of the Psalms even are commentaries on creation. Psalm 104 in particular, he pulls up in this essay. Brueggemann says, the psalmist surveys creation and names it all, the heavens and the earth, the waters and springs and streams and trees and birds and goats and wine and oil and bread and people and lions. This goes on for 23 verses and ends in the 24th with the psalmist's expression of awe and praise for God and God's creation. verses 27 and 28 are something like a table prayer. They proclaim, you give them all food in due season. You feed everybody. The psalm ends by picturing God as a great respirator. It says, if you give your breath, the world will live. If you ever stop breathing, the world will die. But the psalm makes it clear, we don't need to worry. God is utterly, utterly reliable. By the end of Genesis, the notion of scarcity enters Israel's story, although the promise of the creation story continues to live on. As the biblical narrative unfolds, we see cycles of doubt, reassurance, fear of scarcity, fulfillment by God's abundance. What shall we eat? Why did we ever leave Egypt? Followed by manna from heaven. And so, in this accounting of Jesus' parable, Jesus faces hungry crowds, and with a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish, they are fed. Brueggemann says, in this act, Jesus demonstrated that the world is filled with abundance and freighted with generosity. If bread is broken and shared, there is enough for all. Jesus is engaged in this sacramental, subversive reordering of public reality. And yet, I know, you know, we all know that for some people, scarcity is what they live. They're not imagining it. It's their daily reality that they don't have enough to eat or adequate health care or a decent place to live or clean water. And I believe that, at least in part, what Jesus is teaching in this parable is that those who are experiencing radical scarcity have a right to bang on the doors. They have a right to make their needs known. Even if they know that the powers that be don't care about them, they still have the right to speak on their own behalf. They have the right to show up for themselves. They have the right to be visible. They have the right to walk right up to the front doors of the halls of power and say, "Give me justice." The widow uses whatever power she has. She has the power to show up. She has the power to speak, even though she knows the one to whom she speaks has no interest in giving her what she needs, but she shows up. And she shows up, and she shows up. And when the judge relents, he enters into justice making for this woman in spite of himself. Even this hard-hearted one, because we don't read he gets a change of heart. It's not like, you know what? You're right. It's just like, oh my gosh, really? Again? Okay, go away. Even this hard-hearted one is pulled into the bigness of God's generosity. And actually, more's the pity to him that he can't even see it. But maybe he can. Perhaps because of her persistence, he allows himself to see her and maybe reshape his own reality, his own understanding of his reality, his own identity that has been heretofore shaped into a false one. If you're old enough, you may remember certain photographs from the civil rights movement. In the late 1960s, for example, sanitation workers in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, went on strike. They were protesting years of dangerous working conditions and racial discrimination. But this protest that they showed up for in Memphis was sparked by the ongoing dangerous conditions and the deaths of two workers, two African-American men, who had been crushed in the back of compressor trucks. The men were in the back of the trucks because it was raining. And the city law at that time forbade black city employees from sitting in the front of the truck. They didn't have anywhere else to go, so they sat in the back and they were crushed to death. This is where Martin Luther King spent his last days, in solidarity with these workers. And one of the most striking images from the march held by the sanitation workers were those of the men who were carrying signs that simply said, "I am a man. I am a human being, and I'm showing up." These men, in spite of the ways they were being treated by the city of Memphis and American society at large, were announcing their humanity. They were making themselves visible. They were pounding at the door for justice. So often those who lack are encouraged or even compelled to be hidden. We even believe for ourselves sometimes that we don't have the right to have needs, or much less say out loud to someone what it is that we need. And Jesus turns that notion on its head. And of course, we don't even need to look into the distant past. Even now, as has been mentioned this morning, thousands of people are gathered at Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota. Like people around the world who are showing up for themselves and for others, they are putting their bodies on the line. They are knocking at the door for the protection of water, of land. People who live there have asked the world to watch and to stand with them. Brueggemann says, telling parables was one of Jesus' revolutionary activities, for parables are subversive reimagining of reality. The ideology devoted to encouraging consumption wants to shrivel our imaginations so that we cannot conceive of living in any way that would be less profitable for the dominant corporate structures. But Jesus tells us that we can change the world. Brueggemann goes on to say, the Christian community performs a vital service by keeping the parables alive. These stories haunt us and push us in directions we never thought we would go. And may it be so for us. May it be so for us even now on this day in October 2016. May we ever be pushed and pulled into the wideness of God's vision, the glory of God's abundance, and the assurance that we can claim it for ourselves and for each other. Amen.